Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and once again, our special guest is Harry Dent. Mr. Dent is a New York Times best-selling author, known for his ability to look at past cycles and demographics to project what's next for the economy and where to most wisely invest. One of his most famous calls was writing a book in 1992 entitled The Great Boom Ahead, when most of the authors were writing about a repeat of the Great Depression. In 2008, Harry did write a book projecting a Great Depression, and his most recent book is The Great Crash Ahead, and subtitle, For a World Turned Upside Down. Mr. Dent, welcome back.
Yeah, nice to be back, Bruce.
What was that subtitle directed to, For a World Turned Upside Down?
Well, you know, over time, we break the economy over a human lifetime into four seasons, spring, summer, fall, and winter. And it's the winter season where all the gains from the previous three seasons kind of get consolidated and tested, and debt deleverages, and you know, you find out which businesses really have the strengths and which one have the weaknesses. It's a very difficult season, and it's the only time that you see deflation in prices. My thing, when I say world turned upside down, not only real estate going down for the first time in our lifetimes in many places, you know, stocks crashing to a major degree for the first time since the 70s, and you know, banks almost going under, all this sort of stuff. But deflation and prices, but I say that, and people don't even, well, what is deflation? I know what falling inflation is, but you have to go back to the 1930s to see deflation and to see major bank failures like we started to see in 2008 and all the things. And so, yeah, it really is for most people. It is a world turned upside down, and it's the most challenging season in our economy like the 1930s were. But for the smart investors that get out and then reinvest when things crash, especially in areas like real estate, you know, where we're already seeing a downturn greater than the Great Depression. I think you got farther to go in many areas. You're going to see the world on sale. Businesses that survive this kind of survival of the fittest threat are going to have much less competition and have market share thrown at them like General Motors in the 1930s. So there's huge opportunities, but for most people, they're going to be like, oh, what happened? I can't make any money on my savings anymore on bonds, and my stockbroker told me diversification would protect me, but in 2008-9, everything went down. It didn't protect me. And deflation and prices, what is that?
Now, so you, let's say going ahead and not being specific to years, but you really feel that we're in for a deflationary depression rather than inflation.
Yes, yeah, so we got a quick dose. I mean, the M3, the broadest measure of money supply, actually contracted 6% after that first crash in 2008. But then, of course, all this stimulus has gotten us back. My view is, look, if governments are taking trillions and trillions of dollars of monetary creation and stimulus and fiscal stimulus and deficits, and all we're getting is zero inflation in Japan and 1-2% in Europe and 1-2% in the United States, you gotta see that the underlying trend is deflation. Because any other period, if we'd have done this in the 70s or the 80s or not, I mean, any other period in history other than the 30s or now, we'd have massive inflation from this type of monetary creation. So, you know, deflation is the trend, but governments are keeping that. I mean, because deflation means, if you look at history, financial bubbles are bursting. Inflation means debt is deleveraging and being written off and banks are failing. That's what happens when you see deflation, and it doesn't happen very often. It only happened once in a lifetime, in our lifetime, 80 years. Again, last time was the 1930s. So when the government fails, when something goes wrong in the world, or when the markets finally do just say, hey, the stimulus isn't working anymore, we've lost faith in this, and then, you know, we've been getting less GDP growth for every dollar of debt inserted in the economy, private or public, since the late 60s. And now we're getting to where it just takes more and more. It's like any drug. It takes more and more to create less and less effect until the drug itself or its side effects kill you. And that, you know, it's not like an analogy. Debt is a drug. It leverages performance short term at longer-term costs. You got to pay that debt off at some point. And if you keep accumulating debt and interest, you get to the point where you can't pay the debt and interest. Nevertheless, keep your company going, as telling me. So debt bubbles happen throughout history, once in a lifetime. But when those debt bubbles and the financial bubbles that go with them burst, your wealth is disappearing. Debt, which is money, is disappearing, and almost all the money is created through debt. Federal Reserve does not just sit there and print money all the time. They only print money in emergencies like this, and this is a big one. Debt is created when governments borrow, when businesses and consumers borrow. That's what creates money in money supply, and that contracts for a period and then grows again once we get rid of debt, clear the decks, have a big detox, as I call it, a debt detox. Financial assets become more affordable. I mean, wouldn't it be great for younger people? Obviously, older people have been sitting on real estate for decades, don't want to see it go down. They're going to be the losers. But young families are going to be able to afford a better house, lower price, which is going to greatly affect their standard of living. If real estate can just come back down to historical levels, which means correlates with inflation, which means it's got to drop another 20, 30, 40% or so to get back to historical levels, which Robert Shiller has established better than anybody. We're not there yet, even after the bubble burst we've seen, except for a few states and areas. So this sort of thing is good for the economy long term, but it is very painful short term, and governments just are saying, governments have discovered this Keynesian drug that they're just saying, well, the worse things get, the more heroin we'll take. Well, you know, you can always feel better short term, and that's all we're doing from my point of view. If they were restructuring debt, if they were forcing restructuring of businesses, forcing greater efficiency, which happened naturally in the 1930s, even though it was painful, I'd be saying, hey, we're making progress here. They're not. They're preventing all that with all this stimulus.
And what you just said is they consider it less painful to have inflation, I think, Okay, but
mild inflation. They don't want high inflation, but hey, they haven't gotten high inflation.
They haven't really gotten what you're saying, they haven't even gotten inflation with all their effort.
Right. It's been zero in Japan and 1-2% in Europe and the U.S., despite even greater stimulus than in World War II. I mean, the only time to me that massive stimulus and debt creation, you know, that's not productive is necessary is when you're fighting a war. And then if you win the war, it works to your benefit. And if you lose it like Germany or something, it can work against you after World War I. But you know, there's times or short term, like a tsunami hits, you know, like if they hit Japan. You don't want to have a breakdown of your financial system just because a tsunami hit. It's a short term thing. Put in some liquidity, keep the system going. But we've been fighting now for 4.5 years a long term demographic downturn. Baby boomers have peaked in their spending, and they've more than that peaked in housing and borrowing. They're just not going to buy more houses and not going to borrow more. They're done. And debt got to levels twice that we saw compared to GDP in the last bubble that peaked in the roaring 20s. And that debt needs to deleverage. That debt is too big a burden at the consumer level, at corporate level, and especially at the government level and financial sectors, banks and financial institutions. These levels are just way above what can be sustained long term. So we need to rebalance this. And this stimulus specifically is keeping that rebalancing from happening because it would be painful. Look, if you're hooked on heroin, you got one choice. You detox slowly or quickly, and there's just no two ways around that. Detox is painful. But if you keep taking more and more of the drug with less and less effect, you are going to die, or you're going to darn near die and then end up in detox anyway. So there's only one choice, and we're avoiding this choice. Now, there's been a few countries like Estonia and Iceland that didn't have that choice. And couldn't get bailed out and had to devalue their currency and go through a period of austerity. They're doing better. They've been coming out of their recessions while the rest of Europe's been falling into one. Austerity works, but it hurts.
Mm-hmm.
And people are acting like it shouldn't hurt. I'm like, oh, what? Have you looked it up in the dictionary? And if you don't want a hangover, don't drink a bottle of bourbon. But once you've drank the bottle of bourbon, what are you going to do? Act like it never happened or take, you know, 20 headache pills for the next few days and then get more toxic on that. That's kind of what we're doing.
Let's talk about the demographics of real estate. There's a quote in your 2008 book, and it says housing is more likely to bottom in late 2012 in early 2015, and then head back upwards more steadily due to echo boom generated or generation buying patterns. So now, is that something that after looking at Japan, you say that may not happen?
Yeah, that's been a big insight over the last year because, you know, Japan's echo boom generation is not near the size of its baby boom, and ours is not as big, but it's much closer. It's much more substantial. But when Japan's echo boom came along, their economy didn't really bounce, and housing did not bounce back. These younger families should have been buying housing, and they're not. Well, first of all, they've seen a big fall. They're scared to death. They don't have anywhere near the jobs and benefits that their parents had, and they've locked themselves off and kind of demasculated the younger generation. And they're not buying houses at the same rate. But what I finally realized is what's unique about real estate, commercial, residential, infrastructures, whatever, is that it lasts nearly forever. And so when people start dying, they put that house back on the market, and that house was there before, and it'll be there afterwards, and not like a car or a bag of cereal or something that's going to evaporate sooner or later. The dying of the old generation that's larger starts to cause supply of homes coming back on the market that actually, at some point in Japan, this is already the case, and it'll become that way in the U.S. in some years from now, where the supply of old homes from older people is as great or greater than the demand from new younger households, so you don't need to build any houses. And there is no, oh my gosh, we need, you know, there's always a demand for more housing and nowhere to build them, and oh, those will prices go up. No. Home prices in Japan have never bounced, a little bit for a couple years in the early 2000s, but just barely, like we're seeing here, never bounced much and are at new lows 22 years after their peak in 1991. And that 1991 peak actually was at age 42, which is the peak in home buying. It occurs a little earlier than the peak in overall spending at 46 to 47. It's 41 in the U.S. for homes, 42 in Japan. It peaked right with demographics and has fallen, but it didn't bounce with the next generation. So I've got a new indicator that subtracts the dyers from the peak buyers, and it says Japan's real estate after 2015 is going to continue to trend down, and it says this bounce we've had in the U.S. here in 2013 is going to likely to turn back down for years to come. So that's another one of those aha insights, like, boy, I never thought of that. What we normally do, like everything in demographics, we look at peak spending to follow the economy, 46-year lag in the U.S., 47 in Japan. If we're looking at a particular sector, like starter homes, that's age 31 when the most people buy starter homes. Well, we can put a lag on that. Same thing for trade-up homes, age 41 in the U.S. But what I noticed is in real estate, it's just like workforce. We're looking at workforce growth for commercial real estate. Okay, here's when people enter, age 20, 21, but here's when people exit, age 63 to 65. You got to subtract the people exiting because that's the workforce. When people exit, it affects the workforce just like when people enter. You got to do the same thing with real estate. And so that was one of my big insights in the last year, and I'll be a part of this new book, that, hey, real estate may never be the same, which means, to me, we go back to what we learned in Monopoly. In Monopoly, you don't buy Park Place, and then why is the game's going on, and for every hour you sit there, it goes up 20%. You buy it for the rents. You keep getting rents. You put up a certain amount of money, and you keep getting rents and rents and rents. Everybody lands on it. But that's the new game in real estate. Buy real estate at the cheapest prices you're going to see in your lifetime, but don't buy it so much for appreciation. We may get some in the future, but buy it because you want to live on it and improve it, or buy it because you want to rent it out at positive cash flow, commercial or residential. That's the new game.
Sometimes when you look at a generation, probably the assumption is maybe the next generation is going to do similar things. But the echo boom generation has really done something a lot different as far as household formation and getting married. So,
like not.
Exactly.
With their parents, and some of them aren't getting married. The Japanese, I tell you, I saw a survey in Japan. young males in Japan have no, 35% have no interest in sex or dating or anything because they can't afford to support a wife or a girlfriend or a kid. And couples that are a little older, 42% of them aren't having sex for the same reason. So this is serious stuff, serious changes in behavior because of this change in the environment, economic environment.
You expect that to come to the United States?
Yeah, probably to a lesser degree because our demographic downturn is not as severe. Japan is the fastest aging society in the world and with the highest total debt. So it's a bug looking for a windshield.
Yeah, that's a great quote, and it's scary too. In other words, that's the thing too, when you listen to somebody like Malden and he says something like that, you know, it really gives you pause because you go, okay, well, that he doesn't just go off and, you know, half-cocked. He's means that. So you have to analyze that. The Ecoboom generation, they've gone through a great recession, and that stunts household growth.
Yeah.
And you also have this echo.
And it also affects your view for a lifetime. The Bob Hope generation is nothing like the baby boom because they grew up when they're young in the Great Depression and World War II. These people did save money. They were more conservative. Baby boomers grew up in the 50s and 60s and like, what should we worry about?
Mm-hmm.
They never saved and always lived on the edge.
The front end of the baby boomers probably, just doing quick math, are they 68? Or 67, somewhere in there?
No, they're, you know, baby boomers, actually, the front end started retiring, which is 63, we find to be the average age, like in 1998. Half the baby boomers have already retired.
Okay.
And everybody's acting like this is going to happen in the future. The rest of them will retire by, let me calculate this, by 2024 to 2026. I think they're going to start staying in the workforce later because
right.
of they don't have the savings and investment and the jobs and all this stuff. But you know, in a decade from now, baby boomers are going to be retired. So a bigger generation is going to be sitting there retired, aging, spending less, saving more. You know, well, actually, by then, they're going to be spending less and saving less. And not buying houses, downsizing of anything, needing more health care, needing more benefits. I mean, and you've got going to have this smaller generation having to support all the debt they came up and all the debt from fighting the Depression, all the entitlements and benefits nobody had the guts to face until we hit a crisis. I mean, this is one reason, Bruce, I actually almost welcome a crisis. I don't see any way to politically deal with what needs to be dealt with unless people get in reality and realize we have no other choice. In the Great Depression, there was no choice. Banks were failing. Jobs disappeared. Debts had to go under. I mean, there was no bank there to collect the debt. But the flip side of that is, hey, we got rid of a lot of debt, you know?
Yeah, well,
and that debt's not going to weigh on our economy in the future, and we can rise out of the ashes. And these young people that are the most scared now and who have seen in their impressionable years everything from 9/11 and terrorism to the beginnings of a Great Depression and home prices falling. I mean, the baby boomers never saw home prices falling except for a few areas in the early 90s here and there, you know? They are going to have a different view, but the only way to help these people, the only way to change that view is for them to see, oh, yeah, but houses are more affordable, and now things are stabilizing, and we're restructuring this debt, and we're restructuring our student loans, and then banks are going to households and saying, yeah, God, we lent you $500,000 against that $450,000 house. Hey, we're going to have to write your loan down to $300,000. If people started seeing that happen, they'd say, oh, now I feel better.
Well, it's interesting. They're kind of doing it in a two-step process. So you probably, if you're the owner, you're probably hard pressed to get that write off. But they're selling, say, I don't know, 30,000 loans to a big company who's then knocking on your door
right.
and saying,
yeah.
"Let's make a deal."
And renegotiating with it, yeah.
Yeah. So that now, are you still concerned about shadow inventory? Because I'll say up front that I did what one time fear it. I don't anymore. So if you are, what do you include in shadow inventory? What categories of properties?
Well, the broadest definition is both foreclosures that haven't been sold and 90-plus day delinquent loans. And that, at a peak, that hit $5.4 million in 2010 and now it's going down to $3.4 million, which is really that's an impressive reduction. And if the economy did continue, if we continue to grow at 2% a little higher, and we continue to see housing prices edge up like we're seeing in demand and all this sort of stuff for the next several years, that would continue to slowly work out. The problem is if we have anything go wrong and we fall in another recession, you know, it's one thing in the first round to think, oh, we can hold back a lot of this inventory because the Fed's going to turn around the economy and home prices are going to come back. But if home prices go down again, which I think is going to happen in the next couple of years or so, then it's like at some point to the banks, it's like, well, whoever dumps first gets the best price. Yeah, it may be bad, but there's a point where people lose confidence that the Fed can artificially bring back the economy. I mean, if after this much stimulus, we go into another recession, which I think is going to start in 2014, and if it doesn't by then, I'm going to back off to some degree. But if that happens, I mean, just imagine businesses, consumers, investors, if you took this much Viagra and nothing happened, then you got ED. I mean, you got economic dysfunction here. And that's what I'm saying is underneath this, that if it takes $2 trillion in stimulus in the U.S. alone, fiscal and monetary, a year on average, to create 2% growth, which is a little over 300 billion a year in GDP. I mean, that is taking a lot of Viagra and having little results, and it means you got a real fundamental underlying problem. I mean, that's the way I look at the economy today. I don't care what the economic statistics are past the point. Just that ratio right there tells me this is not right. This is not sustainable. Because if I'm right about demographic trends continuing to weaken over the next decade before they turn up again, and they will, and this much debt and shadow inventory have to be slowly worked off, well, if we're going to do this for the next 10 years, what's our government debt going to be? Well, try $30 trillion. What's the Federal Reserve balance sheet going to be? Well, try $15 trillion instead of $4 trillion. I mean, this gets ridiculous at a point. You get to where you took enough painkillers to get through the pain and then to slowly deal with it, but then you get to the other side of the fence and it's like you have no health left. You've destroyed yourself and you've got more debt than ever. How do you crawl out of it even when things turn in your favor again?
What's interesting, you know, Riverside County happens to be where I live, and I just visited Tampa, where I think you had made reference of. Yeah. So both of those areas were pretty hit. And Riverside right now has about 2 months' supply of inventory. And we have a bunch of people that were foreclosed on in 08 and 09 now reentering the market on top of normal demand. And so it's, you know, I'm in the house buy-sell business. So we have a lot more demand than we have inventory.
Yep.
And I don't, you know, that's what I, you know, and I really appreciate you telling me about your change in your stance on the echo boom generation, you know, and their impact, because I look at those numbers and I think you also just said that this is not it's not an overnight process. That's the thing about demographics, and we only have a minute and a half, is that it plays out. So you don't have all of the people that are going to be net sellers already doing that. They're going to inevitably.
Right.
And this echo boom generation that could counter it probably will buy a lot of beginner houses in the beginning,
yes,
which might be different than the houses that are being sold.
Yes. And we tell people, if you are going to buy houses and flip them or rent around, you want starter homes. You want affordable starter homes in good areas. The McMansions on golf courses, they may see their last little hurrah with the top 1% doing some well in this bubble, but then this bubble bursts, the top 1 to 10% are going to get hit harder than anybody. But demographics says nobody's going to really want to make mansions in the next decade. So apartments and starter homes, and on the flip side, vacation homes. Once there's another wash out there, aging baby boomers, the ones that are doing the best are going to want a vacation home again. So there's one more cycle on that. But the middle part, those big trade-up homes, that's the worst place to be in real estate, along with commercial real estate.
Okay. Well, Harry, we've had a great time talking in the last couple of shows. I really appreciate your expertise. Like I mentioned, don't always agree, but I always respect your willingness to go out and make statements that leave no doubt where you stand. So I really appreciate your time. Thanks for joining us.
Okay. Thank you, Bruce.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.